If you speak the truth, have a foot in the stirrup.
Hello, and welcome to another installment of the Sea Realm Podcast. I'm your host, KMO, and this is episode number 568, Giant Monster Worldviews All Out Attack, with guest Keith Preston. Prepared for release onto the World Wide Web on Saturday, January 30th, 2021. And that title, that's an inside joke for Godzilla fans. The new trailer dropped for Godzilla vs. Kong. It looks like it's going to be exactly what I want it to be. I'm one of the rare breed who absolutely loved Godzilla King of the Monsters. But anyway, those are not Sea Realm topics, and I know, even having mentioned pop culture or sci-fi, I'm going to get some feedback from serious people who tell me that that's not why they tune in. Tune in. Wow, what an anachronistic expression. No tuning required. Download and play only. Or, you know, stream it if you want. Whatever works. Before yesterday, it had been a long time since I had last talked to Keith Preston. I don't think I talked to him at all in 2020, so we had a lot of catching up to do. So we're going to talk about the obvious stuff. I mean, come on, we're looking back at 2020. We got to talk about the election. We got to talk about the pandemic. Not in that order, though. In fact, most of the juicy election talk I'm going to save for the Sea Realm Vault podcast, which will be out today. Today will be a two-podcast day, no matter how long it takes. Well, I'm tempted to say, hey, let's just jump right into the conversation with Keith Preston. But instead, and I'm going to have to ask the forgiveness of the Sea Realm Vault subscribers because they have already heard this, but I want to share with you a piece of writing that Douglas Rushkoff sent out to all of the people subscribed to his email newsletter. And you'll understand why as you listen to the conversation with Keith Preston, because I tried to reproduce Doug's arguments, but not very concisely. So I want to give you the concise, you know, scripted version up front. I'm looking at an email that Doug Rushkoff sent out 8 days ago, Friday, January 22nd, 2021. And he starts off with just a short personal greeting, and then he pastes in the text of his most recent, or at the time most recent, essay that he had written for Medium. It's called Show's Over, Back to the Real World. And I'm not going to read it all to you, but he starts off talking about how places like Twitter and even more so, you know, the corporate media, they're really going to miss Donald Trump. He was great for their ratings. And then he invokes the book Amusing Ourselves to Death by Neil Postman. And I'll pick up reading here in the fourth paragraph, I think it is. Postman was concerned that migration of news journalism from print to TV would end up turning current events into a kind of entertainment. Text can be debated. Images either capture our attention or not. The values of television are not information or deliberation, but captivation and stimulation. The values of television are not information or deliberation, but captivation and stimulation. Making matters worse, in 1987, the FCC eliminated the Fairness Doctrine, the federal policy requiring television stations to provide a certain amount of news programming in order to keep their broadcast licenses. As a result, TV news went from an unprofitable, mandatory public service to another potential profit center. As we've come to learn, this means favoring sensationalism over information. Big Bang, as the newsrooms I worked in back then called it, referring to any video of gunfire, explosions, or bleeding in war zones. These days it means anything having to do with Donald Trump. The more salacious and outrageous, the better. Those of us on the left became so addicted to the soap opera that we even fell for an overwrought explanation of Trump's 2016 victory as a highly coordinated conspiracy between him and Putin, while simultaneously holding the knowledge that Trump isn't even capable of a highly coordinated conversation. Questions of equivalence aside, many of us on the left succumbed to panic and hyperbole, at least in part because our sense of trauma was being mercilessly magnified by the for-profit media outlets we had entrusted with informing our perspectives. Under the guise of being informed citizens pushing against fascism, Blue Staters dutifully tuned in to Morning Joe, Rachel Maddow, and Don Lemon for a daily dose of outrage. These reports may have been largely factual, but their purpose was less to motivate civic participation than to stimulate a few shots of adrenaline or cortisol. Exaggerations of Trump's gaffes abounded, from miscontextualizing Trump's claim that he was the chosen one to accusing Trump of calling COVID a hoax. We have become no more addicted to this stimulus than the networks have to the ratings and ad revenue. The far right, meanwhile, has gone online and become addicted to dopamine. The news of the day serves as little more than fodder for a LARP, live-action role-playing game, based not on Dungeons & Dragons or the Harry Potter universe, but on conspiracy theories. And because this activity is interactive, the cycle of addiction it engenders is even more compelling than TV. QAnon leverages the mechanisms of fantasy role-playing and fan fiction to engage its participants in a form of active sense-making and pattern recognition. Every time an addict is able to draw a connection between Biden and Burisma, Podesta and Pizzagate, or AOC and Antifa, they get a shot of dopamine. Once the easy associations are used up, players must go deeper into the absurd in order to connect a blackout at the Vatican to the fictional arrest of the Pope, or prove how a 2015 data theft in Italy means that Obama manipulated the Philadelphia voting results remotely. Like a sex addict who needs to resort to progressively kinkier behavior for the same thrill, any of us going down these rabbit holes must dig for deeper and more absurdly totalizing conspiracies to trigger the same sense of release. Making matters worse, the overstimulation of the dopamine system triggers paranoia, which in turn pushes the addict to make more sweeping connections between utterly unrelated phenomena. This paranoia then triggers the least stable among us to commit acts of violence, from shootings to storming the Capitol, or to interpret these tragedies as false flag or MK-Ultra operations of the deep state. People and media on the left then use this violence as justification for more surveillance and control, which triggers more paranoia. And on we go. And then I'll read just the first sentence of the next paragraph, because for me, this is the punchline. These addictions are simply incompatible with a working civilization. So end block quote from Douglas Rushkoff. And now, here is my most recent conversation with Keith Preston.
You're listening to the C Realm Podcast. C stands for consciousness.
Joining me once again for the first time in a long time is Keith Preston of Attack the System. Keith, it's good to talk to you again.
Hi, it's good to be back.
So we didn't talk at all in 2020, so we have a lot to talk about.
Interesting. I didn't know it had been that long.
As far as I recall, the last time we talked was for my radio show, which I haven't done in over a year and a half.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So time flies. 2020. Wow, there's so much to talk about there. I guess we have to start with the pandemic. What are your experiences? What are your thoughts? What are you hearing from people about it? I mean, I know there are a lot of different, very mutually exclusive narratives going around about the pandemic. So what are the people that you're talking to saying?
Well, it's an interesting set of circumstances. It's something that's unprecedented really in modern times. The closest thing that we have to it from history would be the Spanish flu of 1918. I know when the pandemic started, I started researching the Spanish flu because I wanted to figure out, well, how did this work last time it happened? But I know that when the pandemic started, I was thinking it was going to last for a while because the Spanish flu lasted for a couple of years. And it was very similar to this. It started early in the year in 1918, February and March. And then the first wave of it mostly affected older people and people with serious health issues. And then there was another wave of it in the fall of 1918 that was more general and affected people of different ages to a greater degree. And then there were actually four different waves that lasted over about a 2-year period. I think the end of it was considered to be around April of 1920. So if we're following the same pattern, which we seem to be so far, we had one wave in the spring and another one in the fall and winter. It looks like this may be going on for another year or so, or maybe a little over another year. although in that situation, the waves weren't nearly as bad in the latter phases in terms of the number of people affected and things like that. But yeah, so I think, you know, it's already been almost a year since all of this happened. And it's interesting because nowadays we're getting used to seeing people wear masks everywhere we're going and things like that. And it's like living in a hospital. And you know, obviously some people have been more negatively impacted by this than others. People who work in jobs where lockdowns have either shut down their business or shut them out of their job have certainly been impacted the worst by this. And I think that in many ways, the policy response to the situation has been one where the middle class and the upper class have sort of hidden out from the pandemic. And while the working class continues to bring them things, so it's kind of like the policies that have been established, from what I can tell, worldwide, and not just in any one country. I mean, it varies from place to place, but it looks like the priority has really been to protect the health of the affluent classes on the backs of the less affluent classes, which is not entirely unpredictable. So that's, I think, has been the main socioeconomic effect of it globally. The response of the United States to the pandemic has been the worst of just about any country, or one of the worst, because the U.S. has pursued, well, it's been geographically based. Different states and localities have had different policies, but we've pursued the same lockdowns that many other countries have pursued, but without the same level of relief and support provided for the people who were displaced by these lockdowns. I mean, they had no problem with bailing out Wall Street, the banks, and all of that when that started going under. That didn't take long at all. Meanwhile, they spent a year arguing about whether to send out another $600 check and things like that. One thing that it's really done is expose the level of total indifference that our own elite have to the public good. It's similar to this is probably an apocryphal story, but there's the story about Queen Marie Antoinette when she was asked, well, the people are demanding bread, and she said, well, let them eat cake, indicating I doubt that's a true story, but the myth behind that is, well, the French elite in the years leading up to the revolution, the French Revolution, part of their problem was their total indifference to the needs of the people, which cost them their heads in some instances. And we've actually seen bits and pieces of that in the last year. I don't think it's any coincidence that after a lockdown had taken place for about 3 months, we started having a wave of riots. The situation with George Floyd, I think, was just the catalyst. Certainly things like that have happened before. There have been riots, more localized riots, in response to situations like that. But I really think that the George Floyd incident was just sort of the straw that broke the camel's back or whatever. I was actually talking to someone I know who was once a prison guard, who was saying that the riots over the summer are very similar to prison riots, meaning when you have inmates on lockdown or something, like, let's say that there's a disciplinary action, you put inmates on lockdown, they don't start behaving better. Instead, they'll throw a tray at you when you bring their food or something like that. And he said, yeah, this is just a prison riot writ large. And I do think that's kind of what happened. Because the most serious lockdowns were the ones that were initially imposed, which were in the spring. And after everyone had been under lockdown for about 3 months and there was no work, there was no school, there was no sports, there was no clubs, there was no bars, there was no concerts, there was nothing like that. All of a sudden, there's this wave of rioting, which was interesting that happened when it did. I don't think that would have happened without the pandemic. It's also interesting to see the way in which the public health authorities have constantly shifted the narrative. I know when the pandemic started, they were saying, well, don't bother wearing masks. That's not going to help you any, which I thought at the time, well, that sounds foolish. I mean, if this is a contagious illness, of course, wearing masks are going to help. That's why they wear them in hospitals and during surgery. I mean, nobody would wear them in the medical world if they were useless. Then, of course, they did an about face on that. Then they started insisting that everyone wear masks and said, oh, by the way, we were lying about that. We just didn't want people hoarding masks. No problem. They were also, another thing too, was that when the protests started, you had all of these people who for months had been saying, well, don't venture out of your house. You know, don't go to a wedding. Don't go to a funeral. Don't go to the store. Now they were saying, oh, but it's okay to go and protest. Just wear a mask while you protest. So what we've seen is that we can't believe a word public health authorities say. We see that the sources of information we have, whether it's government officials, whether it's the media, they constantly shift their framework in order to bend the narrative in the direction they want to take it in at a particular time. And I, like I said, I don't think the civil unrest we've seen in recent times would have happened without the pandemic. In fact, I think the incident with at the Capitol on January 6th, you know, was just another in the series of events. You have a situation where not only do we have the economic effects of the pandemic, but we also have the ongoing economic effects that are still with us from the last economic meltdown 12 years ago. And then we also have the wider cultural polarization we've seen in our own society that keeps building up, and then which has been escalated in the Trump era. We see all this going on. And also the psychological effects, I think, of the pandemic for some people have been very negative. It hasn't affected me personally because the kind of work that I do, much of it was online anyway. So I was always sort of a remote worker. And I also do work in higher education, and a lot of that just simply moved online. So I was like, okay, I don't need to go to work, fine. So for, you know, lucky people like me, it's been kind of like a you know, going on vacation or something. But as for less privileged people, it's not, you know, it's been a lot more negative, not only in terms of not being able to work, not only in terms of not having a steady income and all the things that go along with that, being threatened with eviction. I think something like 40% of the U.S. population is on the verge of eviction now. But also just the psychological effects of not being able to socialize or go to things like family events and things like that. I'm not somebody who really craves that kind of thing. So once again, I haven't suffered tremendously with all of this. But it was true that in my own family, there was no Christmas this year. There was no Thanksgiving gathering this year. And for some people, they're basically becoming isolated and socially isolated in a way that most psychologists will tell you can be problematic for people's mental health. And one thing I think is particularly interesting too, I was talking about this on another program a while back. What about children? What about someone who, say, when the pandemic started, they were 5, and by the time this is done with, they're going to be 7 or 8. And during their early childhood formative years, what they're used to is, well, there's no school because there's a deadly disease going around. And everywhere they go, they see people wearing masks. That's going to be life as they know it. You're going to have a lot of smaller children that are, that are going through their formative years during all of this. That this is going to be their form. These are going to be their earliest memories. People are going to ask them later in life, "What are your earliest memories?" "Oh, back when everybody was wearing masks." So we have to consider the psychological effect of that when it comes to things like child development, which I think decades down the road, I think we're going to see some fallout from that.
True that. You know, I have a 20-year-old son, and he's socially awkward. He's a very smart kid, and he's got, you know, smarts that I don't have, and like math and science and computer programming and music, and his skill set with the right training, you know, could lead him to a lucrative career. But because he doesn't want to get out and deal with humans, you know, he needs constant prodding. But this pandemic has just been a dream for somebody who doesn't want to get out into the world. And I really fear for my 20-year-old son, who's just sitting at home, no job, not going to school, no plans to do anything. And the pandemic just, you know, validating it. And not only validating it, but making it really the only, he could do some online study, which I wish he would, but really, you know, the pandemic validates his desire to be a shut-in. So, you know, it It doesn't come at a good time for anybody, really. But yeah, for people who are just, you know, at a stage in life where you're supposed to like be gathering some momentum, to have everything just locked down and frozen, it's, things are not going to start rolling again just as soon as you, you know, remove the barriers. That I think the lockdowns and the stagnation that has descended upon not just the economy, but a lot of people's lives is going to have some, you know, some staying power. It's going to take quite a bit to overcome that. So I'm very concerned about that.
Yeah, I think a lot of the focus has been on the economic effects of this, which is, are obviously serious. But yeah, the psychological effects, particularly for younger people, I think in the long run are going to be a big deal. You know, I know in my own circle, I know people who have kids who are, say, high school age, and they're going to school online, or they're going to school part of the time, part time, or something like that. But they'll talk about how their academic performance has declined because either the quality of education they're getting is just not good, or they're just not as motivated, or and also their social circle, you know, has, it takes or the lack of a social circle, the fact that they can't go do things with friends and all that like they, you know, would expect to, has seems to have taken a toll at some point as well. You know, I one of the things I do is I teach university classes, and I'm teaching online. I've noticed that students seem to be less motivated with the online classes. You know, there's less participation. A lot of them just don't seem to think it's a real class because it's online. And I think that that is going to be problematic in a long ways, because, you know, in the long run, you're going to have a lot of students that are going to just develop bad study habits. And it's going to be hard to get back into the groove of, oh yeah, I've got to start taking school seriously again.
Well, presumably they want real credit for the class.
So. Yeah. It's something that I've noticed. I've noticed that the students just aren't taking their work as seriously as they once did. I mean, not that they always did, but there's been a decline in the seriousness.
Well, politically and philosophically, you describe yourself as a pan-anarchist. As an anarchist, what would you like to see the government doing, or what sort of social response would you prefer to see over what we've had?
One thing people have asked me about since all this started, they say, well, you don't believe in government, right? So how would we have dealt with the pandemic? And I'm not a medical scientist, so I don't know all the ins and outs of that well. But as far as the lockdowns and all of that, first of all, I think they were a mistake. I think that it was greatly a case of overreach. You know, as the question of how you would handle something like this, say in, you know, in some abstract utopian society where there's no government or anything like that, you know, there's different ways you could look at that. Well, would it be a matter of freedom of association where neighborhood associations create their own policies, or individual businesses have their own policies, or schools have their own policies? You know, it's all a matter of, well, go where you feel safest, or, you know, if you want to go to a bar where they don't care if anybody wears a mask, fine, that's on you. Or, yep, you know, that's one way to looking at that. But I do think it was overreach in many ways. I think that a lot of, you know, it's one thing I think is particularly unfortunate is the way that this has become a political issue, in the sense that it's just become another culture war issue. You have some people on one end that are saying that the virus doesn't really exist, or if it does, it's not dangerous, or, you know, or, and they're saying that any restrictions at all, even private ones, even voluntary ones, for public health reasons, are an intolerable abridgment of liberty, which I think is kind of excessive in some instances. You know, some of the ideas you see coming from some of the anti-lockdown protesters. And then, of course, you have the other side. They're saying, well, you know, if you don't wear a mask, you're going to kill grandma. You know, it's and they, you know, so the different sides have tried to weaponize this and make it into a political issue. And I think the government and policymakers and all have contributed to that. And it's not just people, something people have done on their own. But I do think that the lockdowns were overreach in many ways. I don't know that it was necessary to totally shut down for months, you know, virtually all business except things that are absolutely essential and things of that nature. And I do think that if that was going to be the policy, there should have been a means of dealing with the economic fallout in a way that wasn't addressed. you know, you've got people saying, well, there should have been more extensive unemployment benefits, or there should have been universal basic income. I think something like that probably would have been should have been implemented if this was the route that was going to be taken, if this total lockdown route was the route that was going to be taken, which I'm not convinced is necessary, was a good idea. And with the benefit of hindsight, I'd say that it was probably overreach in many ways, that the emphasis should have been on quarantining the most vulnerable people and people that were most likely to catch the disease and have serious health issues. And then the resources should have been steered towards assisting those people. But you know, it is what it is.
Well, 2020, with both the election and then the pandemic, seemed to exacerbate a culture war, which was already at a fever pitch. I'm interested to hear, you know, what sort of clashing worldviews you encounter in your conversations with the various people with whom you have contact.
Well, you mean concerning the pandemic or concerning the...
Well, as I say, the pandemic accelerated something which was already raging. So, you know, talk about the effects of the pandemic on people's behavior, on the worldviews they gravitate to. Like, you know, a QAnon was around before 2020, but it really exploded in 2020 in terms of, you know, people being aware of it and taking it seriously. And I quietly monitor a QAnon group on MeWe, and it's really fantastical. I mean, literally fantastical in that the people are spinning these fantasy stories with one another, just reaching for any sort of, like, I saw arguments that referenced a fan site, an alternate history fan site, and was pointing to particular pages about how the Vatican owns New York City and owns Washington, D.C., and how We the People, which had been capitalized, just the first letter in each word had been rendered in all caps to make it a corporation. I mean, just fantasy stuff. And you can see that the documents these people are linking to, just explicitly in the URL, this is a wiki for alternate history fans. And yet, you know, it's grist for the mill, that the QAnon folks are like in a creative fever, just grabbing all these different data points and narratives and weaving them into this grand conspiracy. And it's very bizarre to watch, but at the same time, and this is Douglas Rushkoff that I'm quoting here, you know, the QAnon folks and the people spinning, you know, grand conspiracy narratives, they are sort of getting a dopamine hit, you know, from this creative activity, this collaborative sense-making that they're doing. But the folks on the left who are just getting agitated and they're having their agitation stoked by the mainstream media, they've become addicted to stress responses, you know, adrenaline and cortisol, which puts you psychologically in a way worse place than somebody who's getting high on dopamine, you know, because they're engaged in this ongoing creative activity. So, you know, while the QAnon stuff is certainly much crazier in terms of, you know, could this literally be true? Absolutely not. But, you know, in terms of their psychological state, I think that the Red Tribe is doing better than the Blue Tribe for the most part these days.
Yeah. And it's interesting to see how all that's unfolded, because increasingly we see these polarized extremes becoming even more polarized and even more extreme. But although it's not uncommon, though, whenever there's a time of crisis for people to start going off and developing a lot of weird beliefs and ideas. I mean, historically, you'll frequently see that. You know, cults thrive during times of crisis. One thing that I started to notice way back in the 1990s, and this had to do with the impact of the farm crisis from the 1980s, where in a lot of rural areas of the United States, particularly in the plains areas of the, you know, the Midwest or those areas, you started to see a lot of traditional farming communities that were devastated by the impact of the farm crisis. And you started in those days to see a lot of people from those communities that were drifting off into further and further fringe ideas. And then that escalated after the incident at Waco in 1993, and some other stuff like that. There was this subculture that developed that was often considered far right, but it was so bizarre, it really couldn't be labeled anything. But you had this subculture that was starting to develop that would mix things like the most outlandish conspiracy theories with religion, with the occult, with alternative pseudo history, like alien astronauts, like science fiction, like UFOs, and all kinds of weird legal theories and weird economic theories, and you know, stuff like what you were just talking about, like the QAnon people. The QAnon people are a current manifestation of that. But I've noticed, I was starting to notice this back in the 1990s. And it looks like with QAnon and some other things like that, it's now crept more and more into the mainstream. It's now become more and more of a, I wouldn't say normal, but it's becoming increasingly normalized. As far as the incident at the Capitol, a lot of the more aggressive people that were involved in that were part of this QAnon movement. I think the guy with the horns, the antler horn helmet or whatever, was one of them. I think the woman who was killed and was shot, I think she was a QAnon. We're starting to see these increasingly bizarre belief systems working their way into the mainstream. One thing that I think is a problem is that we're talking about stuff you get from the mainstream media. The mainstream media just there, you know, the narrative that they tried to spin during the entire period of Trump's presidency was that Trump is the root of all evil, and if it wasn't for him, everything would be fine.
Because everything was great in 2015.
Yeah. Well, maybe for them it was, but for most people, it's not. I think that's a real issue, is that you have people, you know, we have this widening, not only do we have this widening cultural division, but we also have a much wider widening class division. Mm-hmm. And, you know, people who live in the large urban centers and have, you know, professional careers and you know, upwardly mobile are just becoming completely detached from other people. And they just don't have a clue much of the time. You know? So when something like what happened with the riots at the Capitol happens, I'm like, where is this coming from? You know, but it's something that's been a long time in the making. I think that one thing that's interesting is the way that this guy Dr. Anthony Fauci has been made into this, you know, saintly figure. I joked recently, I'm like, pretty soon they're just going to make a pope or something like that. But if you know anything about this guy's history, he doesn't have a very good history. I remember him from the 1980s and 90s when the AIDS crisis first came along. And back then he was a fear monger, in the sense he would say things like, you know, well, third of the world population might die of AIDS or something like that. It's going to be the new bubonic plague. Public health officials would say stuff like that back then. When the pandemic started, and I saw that he was, you know, the leader, you know, the head of the White House response team or whatever, I was like, oh, not this guy again. But all of this is having this effect of sort of unraveling the wider social fabric, in the sense that not only are people becoming polarized over politics and the culture war stuff, but now that's been escalated. It's like we already had this a society that was experiencing extreme polarization, that was experiencing widening class divisions, that was experiencing a lot of negatives in other ways, and then the pandemic came along and gave it all a good injection of steroids. And then on top of that, you've had the riots, you've had everything going on with Trump's election, and that's brought us to where we are now.
You know, one thing I've noticed, and this is not new, I've been seeing this for over a decade, and it's probably been going on much longer than that. I've just been paying attention for about a decade, is that there are a variety of conspiracy theories that are aimed to appeal at wealthy right-wingers. And they usually involve basically just wiping the slate clean, saying the US dollar doesn't exist anymore. If you owned dollars in the past, you don't own them now. We're redistributing everything to everybody, you know, equally. And this is something that, you know, somebody who has accumulated a lot, this is something to inspire fear. And usually I see this conspiracy theory touted by guys in suits who are looking to sell. In the past, they were looking to sell you like some sort of gold product, like a gold certificate or something, you know, because your dollars were going to just vanish and you needed hard currency. And in recent years, I've seen it used to sell Bitcoin, you know, to people who wouldn't really understand how to even buy Bitcoin, you know, much less mine it. So they need to have an intermediary, a broker of some sort, to sell them Bitcoin, or, you know, to make the purchase for them, you know, for a commission. But now I think that has been recast as the Great Reset. You know, people are talking about how to build back better, you know, in the aftermath of the pandemic. And for people with a particular paranoid sensitivity to money issues, that means, once again, we're going to destroy the wealth of people who have worked hard and saved, and we're going to, you know, distribute the new money to undeserving people. That's a narrative that I see getting, you know, renewed traction.
Yeah, well, some theories like that are all over the place. There's a lot of different variations of them. And, I do think that within the context of current circumstances, government overreach is a concern. Whenever there's any kind of emergency situation or perceived emergency, there's always a tendency towards government overreach. You know, we saw that after 9/11, for example.
Never let a good crisis go to waste.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. It's also true that the economic effects of the pandemic have been serious and have been disproportional. And we've also seen a big money grab by the power elite. They didn't have any problem at all bailing out Wall Street and the banks and all that kind of stuff. But this subculture that you're talking about, the ones that are always saying, well, you know, buy guns and buy gold, you know, that's a big recurring theme with these folks. Yeah, I think they've really gone crazy during this. I mean, not that they weren't before, but this whole subculture, I've noticed that the entire subculture that buys into stuff like that, or collection of subcultures that buy into all these ideas, have really gone off the deep end in a lot of ways. On the left, I've seen, ever since Trump has been president, there's always been this thing about, well, there's this coming fascist dictatorship, you know, where the Fourth Reich is right around the corner. I've seen that idea being spun quite a bit as well. I even knew people that were making sure they had their passport so they could leave the country and that kind of stuff when Trump was elected, you know, because, oh no, here it is, it's the Fourth Reich. And all of that has just created this climate of conflict that, you know, where nobody really trusts anybody anymore. It's one thing that's interesting about the United States is that what it reminds me of, not that it's at this point yet, but it reminds me of things that I have read about periods leading up to civil wars in some other countries. One example I always like to use when I discuss this is Lebanon in the 1970s and 1980s. In the 70s and 80s in Lebanon, there was a civil war. And it was one of these kinds of civil wars where you had dozens of factions and constantly shifting alliances. And it was really more like the gang fights that you see in the inner city between, you know, these are that gangs, where there's a bunch of different gangs and there's a shifting gang coalitions and this gang was our friend yesterday, they're our enemies today, they'll be our friend again tomorrow, that kind of stuff. That kind of stuff is what the civil war in Lebanon was like, is what the civil war in Syria was like. The civil war in the former Yugoslavia was somewhat like that as well. And increasingly, I see the United States, I'm not saying a civil war is going to start tomorrow, but we are being fragmented into this kind of collection of tribes that really has nothing in common with each other, that view each other as existential enemies. In fact, I've discussed this with people who are very partisan politically, you know, who vote blue no matter who, you know, vote red till you're dead or something like that. And I'll say, yeah, it just seems like I'll tell people like that. Yeah, it seems like the two sides are almost like they view each other as enemy countries or something like that. And they're like, yeah, that's kind of how I view it. So that kind of polarization is taking place. And we saw that with the election. Of course, the riot at the Capitol was by people who was convinced that the election had been stolen from Trump. And they thought that Trump was trying to engineer a coup to subvert the Constitution or whatever. But at the same time, when Trump was elected, there were plenty of people who were saying the Electoral College should refuse to seat Trump. They should invalidate the results of the election. because he, you know, he's just so unqualified and things like that. So it comes from both angles. You know, there are also foreign conspiracies. You know, like I know for during the entirety of the Trump presidency, MSNBC was pushing this Russiagate narrative. Well, Trump is really Putin's puppet or something like that. Now they're the right wing is calling Joe Biden Beijing Biden. They're convinced that he's a puppet of the Chinese. So it's like the, I guess the right, for whatever reason, hates the Chinese, and the left hates the Russians the most. So, you know, I mean, who knows why? There's probably some kind of reason for that. But they're accusing the different sides. They're accusing each other of being foreign puppets and all of that. So that's interesting to observe.
Well, Russia, particularly under Putin, has pushed culturally conservative policies, which are anathema to the American left.
Yeah, exactly. They have this idea on the further fringes of the left. You have this conspiracy theory that's being put out where it's the mirror image of McCarthyism in many ways, because you have the Kremlin at the center of this evil global conspiracy. Only this time it's not to enslave the world with communism. Instead, it's to promote world fascism. So Russia's sort of like the epicenter of world fascism and building alliances of fascist parties all over the world to, you know, subvert all good things like gay rights and, you know, this kind of stuff. In fact, whenever people say from the left, you know, like you have sectors of the left that have a more favorable view of Russia or a more favorable view of China or something like that, or have a more third worldist type of outlook, or, you know, kind of a beyond left or right outlook, they'll accuse those people of promoting a red-brown alliance, you know, a communist fascist alliance, something like that. I mean, even somebody like Dr. Jill Stein from the Green Party was accused of this, you know. Like I once saw some of these far left, you know, Russophobe people accusing the Green Party of being a third positionist organization, implying it's really a fascist party, which is interesting.
Well, Russia and Putin have really muddied the waters here in America by sponsoring Russia Today, you know, their news network,
yeah. Uh-huh.
Where they hire otherwise marginalized dissident voices from the United States, you know, people like Chris Hedges.
Mm-hmm.
And they give him a TV show in a professional setting, and it looks just almost as good as, the CNN or MSNBC or, you know, any other big money networks. And yet, you know, it's amplifying voices that have, I think for the most part, you know, a very valid criticism of American politics and American culture, but, you know, it's not because the Kremlin necessarily agrees with the arguments being made. They just do it because it's divisive.
Yeah, I know people who have worked for Russia Today, and they'll tell me that at Russia Today, the editorial position is, we don't really care what you say as long as you don't criticize Putin. You know, you can't be overly anti-Russian. But other than that, you know, you say what you want. There's a number of foreign networks like that. There's Press TV, which is an Iranian network. I've been on that myself. I've been on Russia Today myself. There's a Telesur, which is Venezuelan. There's a Chinese network like that. There's also Al Jazeera, which is Qatar, which is, you know, kind of, you know, where
I like Al Jazeera. I watch Al Jazeera almost every day.
Yeah. Where they stand in international relations is kind of, you know, muddled. They're kind of got their own thing going on because they don't get along with the Saudis either. But I do think that is interesting, though. You do see these media subcultures developing where it's almost like churches. You know, one thing that I've often said that about the way modern societies like our own work is in older societies, the institutions that would disseminate the values of the society, you know, the norms of the society, were typically organized religion. In a modern society like our own, where religion is less influential, at least hardcore religion is less influential. Instead, that role has been picked up by educational institutions and now by the mass media. So in many ways, it's like you have the, you know, the red tribe that watches Fox and the blue tribe watches MSNBC and the, you know, whatever other tribes watch Russia Today and whatever. It's really like churches, you know, it's really like it's, you know, instead of being a worshiper at the Catholic Church or the Protestant Church or the synagogue or whatever, instead it's they attend the Church of Fox or the Church of MSNBC, because I mean, I know people that are really into that. Like, I know people who are very evangelical Christian, and they follow these Fox News hosts and conservative talk radio guys, these Rush Limbaugh, Sean Hannity types. They follow that just like they follow their favorite online or media ministers, you know. So they'll get their religion dose, and then they'll get their political dose, you know, and they sort of blend it together. And the people on the left are probably less likely to be religious overall, but they still have a kind of religious mentality about a lot of their ideas. You know, it's, in some ways, it fills the same psychological role or social role as religion for other communities. So it's, in many ways, it's like a quasi-religious war. You know, I've often compared it to the conflict between the Shia and Sunni in the Middle East. You know, I've often said, well, we've got the red tribe and the blue tribe. They've got the Shia and Sunni, say, in the conflict between the Saudi bloc and the Iranian bloc, whatever. And of course, whenever I've mentioned that to actual red tribers and blue tribers, they've always vehemently denied that, because, you know, their views represent the one true faith, not just another tribe's.
Right. Well, everybody represents the one true faith.
Right, exactly.
You know, speaking of religious takes, particularly from religious conservatives in the U.S. toward Donald Trump, I heard an interview the other day just with a guy on the street who said, Trump is not a godly man, but he's God's man right now. Which is to say, he's not a particularly religious figure, but he is an instrument of the Lord, you know, for a righteous cause.
Oh, I've heard people from that milieu compare him to biblical figures like King David. You know, he's like our King David. You know, I mean, I find that, you know, hilarious in kind of a, you know, odd way, because, I mean, if you look at who Donald Trump is, I mean, he in many ways symbolizes the kind of, you know, American decadence that these religious right people are supposed to oppose. You know, it's like, This is a guy that's been married multiple times to Playboy models and porn stars. And, you know, and I mean, what does he do for a living? He runs gambling casinos, strip clubs. And, you know, I mean, he has more in common with Hugh Hefner than, you know, say, what you would think of as a very religious person or something like that. And yet he's emerged as their hero, you know.
Well, my mother is very religious, and she despises Trump. Absolutely despises him. She's not, you know, a reliable Democrat voter, but she was very invested in the Democratic primary last year, and invested great hope in the figure of Michael Bloomberg, who was in the race for about 5 minutes, spent millions of dollars, you know, just to get on stage and be humiliated at the one debate he participated in. Let's talk about the Democratic primary. I was an Andrew Yang fan. I sent money to his campaign.
On the CROM podcast, a mind that is stretched by a new experience can never go back, never go back never to go its back, old never go dimensions.
That was Keith Preston. And the conversation with Keith Preston will conclude in this weekend's episode of the CROM Vault podcast. If you're listening in the future and you want to find that episode, it is CROM Vault Podcast, episode number 388. And thanks, as always, to all of the CROM Vault Podcast subscribers. They are the reasons why you never hear me pitching any products on this podcast. They are the perpetual sponsors. And for that, not only do I owe them a debt of gratitude, but so do you, the bulk of the free CROM Podcast audience. If you've been thinking about joining the CROM Vault for quite some time, but just never got around to it, well, when the time does come, go to patreon.com/KMO. And now we've pretty much reached the end of the podcast, but before I go, I would like to return to Doug Rushkoff's Medium piece. You know, I read a few paragraphs from it before the conversation with Keith Preston, and now I'm going to pick up exactly where I left off and give you just a few more paragraphs. Not reading to the end, but just a section that I think, particularly combined with the portion of conversation with Keith Preston that you just heard, really stands on its own and provides, I think, a bit of a capstone to the conversation. Doug Rushkoff writes, "These addictions are simply incompatible with a working civilization. Civilization is a compromise. At some point, we surrender some aspects of autonomy for the common good. Wearing a mask in public sucks. But it's only being experienced as a personal humiliation because it's been cynically leveraged as a symbol of castration. It's important we acknowledge and restore the dignity that middle America has lost to neoliberalism's outsourcing of jobs, military pursuits, and opioid profiteering. We don't need to retrieve the protocols of the Elders of Zion's child abuse mythology in order to do so. It's only the addictive cycle that's calling for scapegoating, always just 1 week away from being realized. Likewise, the far left must give up its dream of the ultimate purge that will somehow cleanse America of racism and other retrograde views. Critical race theory is still closer to an academic art project than an actionable civic strategy. Attempting to identify and cancel everyone who supported Trump or his crazy conspiracy theories, while satisfying, may not be the most practical path toward restoring the civic fabric or even race and gender equality. Bit of an understatement there. Continuing, turns out we don't have the easy solution for democracy or human civilization. It's a struggle. It happens way too slowly, and efforts at making sense of the whole picture will always leave us incomplete. It's just too complex. Our brains are being trained to seek certain and totalizing answers for such paradoxes, and to be intolerant of the incomplete and unresolved state in which we actually live. Rather, we must begin to make sense of the world together. Using the attack on the Capitol or Trump's coming impeachment trial as a starting place may not be such a good idea. Yes, an addict has to face real justice for the crimes committed in pursuit of the next fix. But that's not how we address the underlying addiction. The better choice in such an environment is to turn to our actual neighbors and address real problems. Engage in mutual aid, favors. Take our eyes off the instantly gratifying screens and feeds and back onto the real people in our world. The screens only show us what's wrong, and turn any potential activism into some version of fan fiction through which we attempt to interact en masse with the mostly obsolete top-down systems of our society. No wonder we're so frustrated and addicted. The real world is way more accessible, even under a pandemic. It's not even about making friends with our adversaries, but cooperating and solving problems together. We can engage in the hands-on, practical work of creating food security for people around us, building Wi-Fi mesh networks for kids who can't get to school and don't have good access, or do community outreach for healthcare or elder care. There's real service we can do today to relieve pressure, make us less angry and paranoid, demonstrate alternatives to addiction, and replace dangerous dopamine with the bonding hormone oxytocin. So that's all I'm going to read from the essay. There's a few more paragraphs that he takes to wrap things up, but I like ending on oxytocin. One, you know, when you're experiencing an oxytocin-rich neural state, it feels really good. I'd much rather be on that high than adrenaline and cortisol or dopamine. So in the final moments here, I just want to say a few words about craziness. Because from my perspective, both blue and red tribe mainstream worldviews are crazy. And if somebody says or does something that I think is crazy, I don't like to talk about mental illness. I like to talk about craziness. Because as Thomas Sasse pointed out in his books, typically the people that are subjected to involuntary, coercive mental health treatment are people who have become a financial burden on others. Because I'm sure we can all think of examples, you know, well-known people and people in our own lives who make plenty of money, who pay their own way, who support themselves, but they believe things that we think of as crazy. And, you know, I used to associate with some hardcore atheists who are just, they really, really hated religion. And among that set of people, there's an aphorism, you know, just a little bit of doggerel. They say, people who believe absurdities will commit atrocities. Well, I think most of us believe something that's absurd, and most of us don't commit atrocities. And when it comes to, you know, people like Antifa or, you know, their Red Tribe counterparts, the Proud Boys or the Boogaloo Boys or what have you, To me, the differences in what they believe are irrelevant, because they do share one key belief between all those groups, and they act on it. And that is the belief that they can make the world a better place by gearing up for battle and going out into the street and beating people up. That is a young man's fantasy. And I'm no longer a young man. And yet, you know, addicted as I am, as we all are, to the sources of so-called information that come to us day in and day out via these screens of ours, I find myself caught up in violent, retributive fantasies. And I just want to train myself, you know, when I'm feeling that, when I'm visualizing, exercising, you know, violent omnipotence to coerce others into doing exactly what I think needs to be done to make this a more stable, sustainable, sane, and humane world, I just need to ask myself, what's my neurochemical profile right now, and what recent stimuli has provoked it? And then, you know, the follow-up questions are, do I want to remain in this particular neurochemical profile, or do I want to change it? And if so, what do I want to change it to, and what's the best thing I can do right now to make that happen? And one thing that is almost always a good idea is to get outside, get out there into the big room under the big blue ceiling, and get some exercise. I say that's almost always a good idea, not a good idea here today, as it's like 13 degrees outside Fahrenheit. That is well below 0 degrees Celsius for you folks listening in countries where, you know, that's what makes sense to you. Now, I want to return just for a second here to Doug Rushkoff's parting advice, which is, you know, get involved in the real world with real people and do real things that need doing. And I know that some people, Marxists, you know, and others who are dedicated to a particular political philosophy will object to this and say that that's not the way that you change society. This, you know, cottage industry starting from the grassroots and working up, you know, the trickle-up positive change model is Pollyanna nonsense. That really, if you want to change the world, you have to do the long, hard work of engaging in the struggle for power, and you have to win. And yeah, I get it. But here's the thing. Doug's recommended methodology, you know, of just working with the people around you, interfacing face-to-face with voices that can be heard without any electronic mediation, that's not necessarily a way to fix the world. It's a way to fix your mindset. It is a way to, let's not even say fix your mindset. It is a way to move in a more adaptive and enjoyable direction. You know, I just took a road trip, and I couldn't really afford to take this road trip. Even though the transportation expenses were paid, you know, my food and lodging were provided, still, it's a week away from my regular work schedule, which is what generates, you know, that activity is what generates income for me. And yet it was desperately needed. You know, I was thinking of moving to Puerto Rico, and I had made an exploratory trip to Puerto Rico just before the pandemic hit and locked us all down. And I did that because, you know, at least my internet research indicated that for what I spend to live here in Vermont in isolation, and I was isolated before the pandemic, I could move to a city and have both an apartment and a co-working space that I could go to every day where there would be other people. They wouldn't necessarily be working on the projects that I'm working on. In fact, they wouldn't be. But they would be in a place that is designated for work, and they would be human beings in physical proximity to me. And that would be an enormous boost, you know, to my sense of well-being and engagement with the world. And as I say, this road trip that I just took, you know, one, it involved a lot of driving, which I don't really enjoy anymore. And two, you know, it took me away from income generating activities for a week, but it also put me in touch with real people, you know, face to face human contact, which is sorely lacking in my life and which I greatly value. So thanks to Kevin Lynn for making it possible for me to go down there on the organization's dime. And thanks to Static Warp Shell for arranging a walking tour of neighborhoods near where he lives in Baltimore, Maryland, where there is both decaying infrastructure, you know, the decaying infrastructure of previously widespread prosperity, but also neighborhoods which have adapted to the changes and are renewing themselves. Now, I know there are other neighborhoods in Baltimore which are not doing nearly as well, but I will definitely be back to Baltimore, as it's a city that does a lot of things right, and it does a lot of things really, really poorly. And as much as I think it's unhelpful that as a society we have become so fixated on accusing anybody that we disagree with of being, you know, crypto racists and really playing up the racial tensions in this country for cynical ends, but in Baltimore, the things that are done right and the things that are done poorly really do break down along racial lines, you know, just looking at the map. So I will have a lot more to say about Baltimore, and I recorded a conversation with Static Warp Shell after our walk and after I was back here in Vermont, and that will be the basis of a YouTube video that will be going up next week. And speaking of YouTube, now that I'm back, I'm still doing my 3-hour daily YouTube live stream where I draw and I engage with the people who populate the chat. So shouts out to the chat regulars. Thanks, everybody, for showing up. You make it enjoyable. All right, and with that, I'm going to wrap up this episode of the Sea Realm Podcast. You know, actually, there's one more thing I want to talk about, and I won't talk about it at length, but you've surely heard of the subreddit, Wall Street Bets, where a bunch of people decided to foil the machinations of hedge funders who were looking to do a massive short sale, a short squeeze, as they call it, on GameStop. And these folks all just, you know, got together and pledged to buy GameStop stock and bid it up, you know, from around $20 to over $200, thus putting the hedge fund billionaires in a tight spot themselves. And now the mainstream media has given a platform to the hedge funders to say this is absolutely unacceptable. We manipulate the market, not you people. And, you know, if the common people are going to get together and, you know, form mobs that foil our legitimate market manipulations, well, then maybe we do need to entertain the idea of some federal regulation here, something which we normally would not countenance. As a result of learning about this story, I went and I joined that subreddit, Wall Street Bets, and I was looking at it today, and there was a post there from one of the founders or a moderator saying, you know, our membership has quadrupled in the last couple of days, which means that 3/4 of the people there are newcomers, which means that the character of the group in a moment like this, when all these new people come in who don't have any past experience with the group and who don't know what the flavor of the group was before this big media event, the character of the group can change radically when that happens. And probably not for the best. You know, what is unique, what is familiar about that group is in peril right now. And I'm not saying don't join, don't look at it, you know, don't inform yourself via that medium, but it just makes me realize, it makes me thankful for the longtime Sea Realm audience. Of course, I was an early podcaster. You know, there are people who have made great names and fortunes for themselves in podcasting, and they took up that activity a decade after I did. And it, you know, I sometimes stew over that, you know. It's like, oh, I was too early. You know, I put my best efforts into this thing long before most people even heard of a podcast or knew what a podcast was. And yet, the fact that, you know, no Sea Realm episode has really ever gone viral in a way that brings a whole lot of attention to me, well, that has helped to preserve the character of the longtime Sea Realm audience. And I've encountered so many of you over the years. And, you know, while I have largely rejected the collapse obsession and the arguments of doomers as being really just simplistic wishful thinking for the most part, I still really value my interactions with the Sea Realm podcast listenership. Measured in dollars and cents, my net worth is probably negative. But measured in human contact, and particularly in contact with smart people who like good stuff, I'm a rich man. So thank you all for that. All right, I'm going to get to work on the Sea Realm Vault podcast now, but thanks for listening. I will talk to you again pretty soon. Stay well.